And, you know, even if you get, you know, at past conventions, if you get some regular person up on stage in that kind of environment, it feels like they're a politician as opposed to a regular person because it's contextualized as such. And now you can do that in a way that feels way more normal, like they literally are the person next door because they're coming to you from next door.
Yeah, quite literally. I mean, or it's seen in the people's home can in fact disrupt connections. So there's a great moment at the Democratic convention where a governor is sitting in her kitchen and she says, in kitchens like this one across America, families are gathering to struggle over bills. And we look behind her and it is this massive sparkling kitchen. And I don't think there are very many kitchens like that across America.
Certainly right? Not mine. It's massive and definitely not sparkling. Hello, and welcome to How Do You Like It So Far, a podcast about popular culture and our changing world. My name is Colin McClay.
And I'm Henry Jenkins.
So hello, Colin. How are you doing? It's been so long since we spoke.
It is true. Feels like, well, time, COVID time is just so strange, right? It feels like the last season ended about a year or a decade ago with, you know, us just beginning to understand our future world, our new normal, as they say, and fast forward to now. And then I'm sure when we get, partway through the season, it's going to seem like another decade from now.
Well, I mean, it has something to do with the fact that since the last time we recorded a podcast, we've had not only the pandemic, but race uprisings. I've had a National Guard occupation of my neighborhood along with looting. We've had murder hornets, fire NATOs. I wonder how they relate to the shark NATOs that I'm sure are just around the corner. We've had an earthquake. There's hurricanes up ripping up half the country. And that's just the starting point for thinking about the plagues and pestilences that have dropped down upon us in 2020.
It's really a remarkable time. When you say, you know, plagues and pestilences, of course, the various NATOs and NADO come to mind in the way that you just described. In my household, however, and in many of those across California and the country, the particular pestilence we're dealing with is the rapid onset of online learning, which is, you know, something I worked on, kind of technology infused learning for many years, and a lot of us held high hopes for. And then we had this kind of radical acceleration from, I don't know if it was zero, but from not very much to everything online and via Zoom, and trying to make peace with that in some way and trying to find utility. And I will tell you, as a parent, as a privileged parent, with two parents in the household with advanced degrees and books on the shelves and people who work on education, it has been a bear. Our kids are, you know, just not enjoying it at all. And that, I have to say, is the story that I hear from lots of other families like ours, who are fortunate enough to have access and, you know, be able to support their kids, that we're not even able to get by, let alone all the families who have different family structures with, you know, with one parent or with essential worker parents who aren't at home. With folks, in, you know, the many millions of families across the country who don't have good internet access or adequate devices, who have smaller households where noise is an issue. So the online learning stuff is just is really concerning. And particularly, you know, you mentioned sort of the movement against systemic racism. And I think perhaps the single, the biggest takeaway from this online or this remote learning kind of moment that we're in is how much it is about equity and how inequitable educational opportunities are right now. I recently reviewed a bunch of kind of the latest research from spring from a variety of different education organizations and scholars. And the conclusion, you know, usually when you do research, it's about like reconciling data that aren't in agreement with each other. So one study finds one thing, another study finds another thing. And every single thing I read was like, aligned in a way that was, you know, great, because you didn't have to do any interpretation, but it was just profoundly depressing. And basically saying for Black folks, for Latino folks, for people in rural areas, for poor folks, for those with disabilities or other special needs, that the experience was worse, that the engagement was lower, that the sustained engagement was lower, that everything about it basically served those who are already underserved less. And so the takeaway is just, this is a really concerning moment for all families, and especially for those who are already facing challenges. And I just, you know, I don't know what to say about how we're going forward. There's a lot of consensus on, as I noted, on, you know, equity issues. And there's also a remarkable amount of consensus on the importance of social emotional learning and highlighting kind of integrating relationships as well as academics into the learning that happens. So there's a lot of, you know, there's clarity on where we need to go. I just don't think there's a lot of capacity to get there in the near term, and teachers and schools and principals and superintendents are hugely challenged. And it, you know, it connects to all the other things that we have seen since, you know, since March, with economic problems, with, you know, kind of political infighting and politics getting in the way of our COVID response, with folks needing to go to work even when it's not safe to do so, to childcare, to family structure. So it's just, it's, you know, something that we really need to pay a lot of attention to in our families, and to look at how we are responding as, you know, communities and as a nation to this, you know, sort of perhaps lesser seen, but even more insidious plague that is now upon us.
No, I think you're raising some really important issues. We were at MIT, when I was at MIT in the 90s, we were running conferences called We Wired the Classroom, Now What? And, you know, we always envision that the shift to more online learning would be accompanied by lots of professional development that helped teachers to understand new pedagogical approaches to thinking about the use of digital resources online, and a deep commitment to the production of innovative educational experiences, resources. People were calling for an online version of public media that would really pave the way for the kind of learning environment of the future we wanted to see. And of course, none of that actually came to pass, right? It was starved for oxygen for decades. So when we decide overnight to throw people off out of physical space and onto virtual space, teachers aren't prepared. The resources aren't there. We don't really know as much as we'd hope to know about pedagogy in this new environment. This, you know, there certainly is a lot of pedagogical insights out there, but the challenge has always been to bring them to scale. The MacArthur Digital Media and Learning Initiatives led to massive amount of research that could be guiding us at the current moment, but got siloed. Individual teachers experimented with it and pushed forward in their own classrooms. But on school system level, state level, national level, it's just not been there. I think this is one of the things that I'm seeing explode in the midst of all of this is the notion of screen time, which has been held over parents' heads for decades. Why aren't they regulating their screen time of their children, right? And I think, you know, meanwhile, the school systems are requiring X number of hours per day of online screen time. So screen time is shifting from something parents should protect their children from to something they're obligated to occupy as school educational policy. The problem is neither of those are the right attitude, right? It's not about the screens. It's about what are we doing with the screens. And it's not about how many hours. It's about the quality of time people are spending. So on my blog this week and in next few weeks, we're running a series of conversations with leading experts, most of whom are parents themselves, talking about this concept of screen time and how we need to rethink it in the age of the COVID shutdown. So I'll be joined by Sangeeta Shrestova, who was a guest of ours a while back, Susan Kresnecki, who is coming up on our show next week, Sonia Livingston, a British authority, Meryl Alpert, who writes about disability and has interesting things to say about the fact that for those who are disabled, this was the norm of how they being housebound and unable to connect and communicate is something they were experiencing for years now, not just the current moment. Craig Watkins, who's going to talk some about race. Leanna Thompson and educator Jessica Early. And we're in the midst of all of that, drop a toolkit for the civic imagination designed for parents to engage with creative play around the television shows their children are already watching. So it's intended to use fantasy to think about basic fairness and our social interactions with others, and just to model ways parents can productively have quality time around media content as opposed to purely seeing it as a babysitter. Not that there's anything wrong with using it as a babysitter. We've all got to do that too.
That sounds awesome, Henry. I'm definitely excited about it. I mean, I think in our household, we went to great lengths to limit screen time and to be thoughtful about how our kids went to that so that they were doing other things. And then all of a sudden, we go to both the required screen time that you're talking about, which is odd as opposed to requiring an outcome, you know, requiring that output. And sort of more challenging sense to the thing that we all deal with, which is you open up your computer to do some, you know, bit of work, and then you get distracted by 4,000 things. And it requires a tremendous amount of self-control that we learn, you know, if we're lucky as adults, to focus on our work. And asking, you know, our kids to do that when what's on the computer is not, you know, or what's in class is not that necessarily that interesting. And they have their computer right there. They can get in, you know, my son's playing Minecraft even as he's listening to his teacher. So it has upended us in so many ways. So I'm really looking forward to you and your awesome guests solving that and giving us some insight on how to address it going forward.
It's taken care of, off the table, no worries.
You know, and the other thing that, you know, this, we don't need to get into this now because it feels like it's a whole other topic unto itself, is what this means for higher education, right? And the way that higher education has been disrupted, USC is almost completely online this fall, as are a lot of universities and colleges. But it really calls into question kind of the entire model of the university community, and certainly has been a huge bummer for me not to be in, you know, physical contact with my colleagues and students and to be able to bump into folks and just talk, let alone, you know, all the ways that we've learned to teach. And I feel like at both, the one thing that is true regardless of education level is, you know, the challenge to reimagine, to reinvent education so that it really is kind of in a sense natively virtual, rather than the virtual version is just a pale two-dimensional unsatisfying imitation of what we used to do in the classroom. And I think that's, you know, that's the sort of the gauntlet that has been thrown down before all of us, is to lean into the affordances that digital technology and remote participation offer and figure out how to make this not just doable and workable, but to make it really fabulous. And, you know, that's going to take some time and some creativity and experimentation and openness to doing things differently and to making, you know, to making mistakes and learning lessons. And a lot of intentionality in the sense of really thinking about, you know, not just, as you were saying, not just screen time, but how we're using the screen, how we're thinking about where our physical location and so on. And we've been engaging in a bunch of that in our Civic Media Fellowship program, where in April or March, we decided to move from a part remote and part virtual fellowship to all virtual. And that's been really interesting, really forcing us to think about, you know, how we use the scant amount of screen time that we're willing to ask of fellows. So how we're intentional about our synchronous online interactions, how we build trust and foster collaboration with a community that's fully remote. And certainly one of the realizations that I've had is that we tend to lean on physicality, on the ability to sit with each other, to share a meal or go for a walk, or, you know, anything, both in a sort of, whether it's in a formal setting like a classroom or an informal setting like the water cooler. We lean on that so much as we think about relationship development and sharing ideas. And when we don't have those things, we need to come up with other ways to support those kinds of relationships and sensibilities and sharing of ideas. So I feel like we've begun that journey, and it's going to be a long one, but that we need to begin it, you know, sort of at scale, and be recognizing that, you know, this, the world that we're in now is going to rely a lot more on virtual community, virtual relationships, different kinds of methods of production of knowledge or media, or you name it.
You know, I think that's opening up lots of rich opportunities for us at the same time. I've given so many talks around the world this summer that I never would have been able to give if I had to physically travel to those places. These schools are often in lower nations that have less disposable income, shall we say, countries that would not be able to afford to fly me out there to give a talk to them. But now I can speak to and engage with people there with the cost off the table, and even the time constraints off the table. It's an hour out of my time to speak to a class in Estonia or an African country or whatever. And I think that's an important dimension of this that I think opens up opportunities for us. But I do find it's hard to read the audience, right? It's hard to tell how people are reacting. And I'm struggling with this in my teaching too, that silences mean a variety of things on Zoom that they may not be what they mean when you're in a classroom facing a group of students. That when your student's faces is a postage stamp, it's hard to read their expression and know who's getting the concepts and who's not. So calibrating as a teacher always depends on a kind of social semiotics where you scan the room and watch people's reactions to what you're saying. And suddenly we don't have that. Or we're at conferences where we're hearing each other speak, but we lose the lines waiting for dinner or the walk from the hotel to the conference center, where casual conversations lead to social networking. It's where some of the most important work of the conference takes place. I usually spend most of my time at a conference with a glass of tea in front of me and talking to people rather than hearing papers, but that's almost impossible to do with the virtual conferences we've set up. So we really have to go back to what we've learned about virtual communities to think more deeply about how do we bring people together in new ways and create these in-between times for sociality, that rather than going directly to the work and then leaving again to go to another Zoom call, to go to another email thing, we don't have the serendipity of the hallway encounter that makes a university a thinking place and not just a formal institution of learning.
And let's be clear, you know, communities are in this moment, you know, in all the, you know, the pandemic and all the challenges that we talked about, in many ways, communities are thriving because people are recognizing the importance of connection with others and are inspired by the need to fight against and fight for the kinds of changes that we need.
Yeah, I think one of the ironies is that for a long time, we talked about the computer standing between us and social engagement with the people around us. And suddenly it is the means by which we socially engage with the people around us, right? And it makes it very clear that it's the function we're ascribing to this device, not the technology per se. So those groups like Fandom say that have experimented with virtual communities, and we rattled through a lot of that in our follow-up episode on communities in the spring, those groups that have that history are ahead of the game and are pushing further to think about what it is to be socially connecting to each other in this really precarious way through the computer, as opposed to seeing the computer as a wall holding us apart.
Yeah, I mean, just as a back to education and for a heartbeat, you know, the way that my kids, and particularly my son, engages with his friends is like 99% playing online video games with them, and also either talking in the game or FaceTiming or whatever in parallel. And that's how they're, you know, they're interacting. And so, although I normally would have, you know, not been so game for so many games or so much gaming, that's their, that is where their community is engaging right now. And so I have to, you know, so like you mentioned fandom, totally get that. I would imagine gaming communities are also on the rise. I know gaming is. I don't know how much that's translating into sort of active communities and engaged communities and folks going beyond socializing. But it does suggest that there are some kind of pre-existing sets of practices and communities that are going to be privileged in this moment. But at the same time, I want to go back to education and what I was saying about equity. And so there I have deep concerns about all those communities who haven't been engaging online. And again, you know, as we face, you know, need for deep and real and widespread change in the country, what it looks like for those groups to transition to being able to engage, not just in real life, but virtually in ways that are, you know, productive and satisfying and emotionally healthy.
You know, and I think this is where we might want to take an audit of the current media environment and what are people actually doing if they're not engaging in social communities, where are they spending their time? And I think if we were to do a thought experiment that said, what if we dramatically diminish the role of mass media in American society for an extended period of time? That's the moment we're at, right? This will 2020 will be the year without movies. Effectively. That's an overstatement. There have been some really interesting films available online so far. Palm Springs, Five Bloods, The Old Guard, First Cow. But we can count on two hands, the number of films this year that have had a significant social discussion around them. So cinema is, for all practical purposes, off the table. The technical advantage that television had is the polish of television is dropping, which means the kind of open television experiments that A.J. Christian spoke to us don't look any worse technically than a lot of the shows that have been produced for network television during the COVID shutdown. We've been surviving off the archives of the streaming services, and they will keep feeding us content, but we're going to have a dramatically delayed start to the fall television season, which means that television will be less a factor in our lives come the fall, which means these other lower tech media have a potential to become more central to us. Except you've been talking about what's happened to podcasts during all of this.
I feel like I've seen some data on this, but haven't checked in most recently that, you know, with the demise of commuting for so many people, and especially podcast listeners, that even as the number of podcasts being produced and the quality is through the roof, that consumption is way down. I certainly know mine is. And that's, you know, it does feel like it's this kind of, you know, the double-edged sword of opportunity where I really, as we talk about some of the shortcomings of mainstream media and the strengths of podcasting as a medium, now I actually want to be consuming more. And this is a medium where you, as you observed with your, you know, giving talks and so on, that is perfect for a pandemic moment where we can't be together in the same way that we're recording this right now. So there's a tension in there of like that opportunity and trying to figure out how do we convert that and how do we really lean into the medium. And we've done, you know, so much on that in the past, so many great shows. And I feel like we probably need another one coming up as to think about how podcasts are changing as we look to this new world.
You know, and I think Twitch is another site. You spoke about gaming just a little while ago, but Twitch has become something much bigger than a streaming platform for gaming as people are creating their own channels. I know my son spends a lot of time in the ASMR community on Twitch, which is really trying to provide calming material for people who feel lonely, who feel depressed, or struggling with the difficulties of the current moment. It's a place to chill. And I think that's a vital need for entertainment at the current time. He hooked me on to this game called Sequestered, which is built by reality fans. And Sequestered involves people basically voting each other out of rooms and moving from room to room. There's usually five or six active rooms. I watched an episode that had survivor contestants from around the world participating together and playing this game. And then the fans and some of the other contestants do color commentary throughout the game. So at its peak, there's seven or eight rooms you could go through. You can't possibly monitor all of them, but the sense of movement from one imaginary Zoom room to the next is the central feature of the entertainment. And I find this idea of Zoom forming rooms, breaking rooms apart, to be really an interesting part of the current moment. I wrote something recently where I quoted Zygmunt Vertov, who in the 20s bragged that he could create a room where each wall existed in a different space using cinematic techniques. And then I look at a classroom today where I have 30, 40 students, each in a different space, constituting a room, and realize that algorithmically we're besting Vertov's wildest fantasies at the current moment.
Yeah, that's the whole breakout phenomenon is definitely an interesting one where, you know, in a conference, you send people off to breakout groups and it takes forever to get them back because they're, of course, having all those, you know, large and small moments and diving in with their kind of their pals. Whereas in a Zoom, it's instantaneous. It's a break from whatever the massive, main room is and an opportunity to connect with folks. So, I do feel like that's into the territory of how do we use digital affordances in creative ways that really help us to create the kinds of experiences that we want. Our colleague our first guest on the podcast, Ahmed Best, taught at USC this spring as an adjunct lecturer for the first time in the drama school. As a new teacher, was faced with this challenge of bringing his drama class online into Zoom. And he said he was kind of nervous about it, but, you know, he was optimistic and just as a creative and innovative fellow, he was just going to roll with it. And he said he was just totally blown away by the things that the kids, the students did using Zoom. And it made me, you know, really gave him sort of hope and introduced new creativity into the process. And our colleague, our former, now senior fellow, former civic media fellow, Amber J. Phillips, who was also on the podcast with Chandra Kumanika about a year or so ago, has been engaging in stand-up comedy and also going to shows and talking about how you have kind of the main screen and then you have the back channel chat that happens. And in a way that both, of course, you can have, you know, something like the comedy experience with the main screen, but that the back channel chat is something that you never could have had in a comedy venue, right? You wouldn't have been able to have a running kind of second screen commentary with the entire room. And that way, other people, other funny folks in the room were able to kind of build on the comedy that was happening on the main stage, as it were. And in some cases, I think the consensus was that those folks were even funnier than the folks who were on the main stage. And so that to me was like, okay, that's a remarkable innovation in how we do a comedy show, and, you know, creates all sorts of neat opportunities.
So let's move from comedy to politics, which is a very small joke move indeed, since we're talking about jokers in either case. But we've now seen some of both the Democratic and Republican national conventions using Zoom, which is to reinvent this massive institution, which has so much encrusted power and tradition around it, almost overnight, to take advantages of the affordance of this new medium. And I've been watching them closely. We're still, as we're recording this, fairly early in the Republican National Convention. But I think it's significant that any new medium represents a new interface between political leaders and citizens. And so we should pay attention to the power relations embedded in it. So as the political conventions move towards Zoom, it's simultaneous with a push to include more voices of, quote, average Americans. And what constitutes an average American essentially means anyone who is not a professional politician. So we're seeing more of those. We're seeing more pre-recorded segments. And we're seeing a need to shift the rhetoric from the kind of booming call and response speech that fills a convention hall to a more intimate, we might have once called fireside chat style, a conversational style where the politician looks at us and speaks directly. And it's fascinating to watch which political leaders are too hot for Zoom, are still too booming, have wide gestures. There was an absurd one on the first night of the Republican National Convention by the girlfriend of Donald Trump Jr., right, Guilford. And she ends up waving her hands madly, shrieking at the camera. It really came across as way too intense. But there were things at the Democratic Convention not quite that intense. Amy Klobuchar came off to me as too cheerful and too booming. And she's normally very natural on television, but on Zoom, she really was overplaying her part in a significant way. Whereas I'd say the younger you are on average, the better you were at communicating through Zoom, unless your name is the Obama, and both Michelle and Barack are naturals in this medium. AOC, who got a minute and a half, was very, very good at this medium. And Biden had figured out how to do it by the time he got to his acceptance speech. And it really played to Biden's strengths at being someone who's supposed to be better in a small room than a large room. And this was like Biden in a small room. They've tried to do these spontaneous moments where the Biden or Trump speaks to average Americans. And Biden came across a little more natural in that setting than Trump did. Trump just can't seem naturally empathetic, even pretend to care about everyday people. But it was surprisingly stiff, even so, to watch him engage with hostages that he helped rescue, or, you know, emergency workers fighting COVID or whatnot. But those moments really don't work well. Interestingly, we saw Elizabeth Warren stop sounding like the girl in the front row waving her head manly for the teacher and calm down. And we heard Sanders not shouting for once. And every other media I've seen Sanders, his natural impulse is to shout. And here he calmed down and spoke to the audience. And it was some of the most effective stuff I've seen Bernie Sanders do in a long time. But I think we're not going to go back to the old school convention again. I think we're going to see political leaders do some kind of hybrid with more pre-recorded segments, more on-location segments, some speeches in halls, but maybe halls scattered across the country, which is going to lower the cost of political conventions and could be another factor in removing the role of big money in the political process, since massive amount of donations come into the parties around these conventions that get spent on the conventions. It's simply a way of exchanging money for influence and doesn't contribute anything else to the political process.
In a way, I feel like, you know, back to AJ Christian's work with Open TV, it does feel like, even though this is still the same, the way you're describing it in this telling, even though it's still the same actors, so to speak, who are creating the convention, the different modes of production could really, you know, are really changing or potentially changing how things work. Now, I'm going to assume, unfortunately, that money and donations in exchange for influence, they're going to find a way to recover that, unfortunately. But the business as usual isn't, right? Like that can't continue. And I watched a bit of the Democratic convention and have not been able to bring myself to watch the Republican version, but I can't, as you're talking, I'm absolutely imagining, and from the bits that I saw, that people are, they choose where to present themselves as opposed to being in the great hall or in the stadium or whatever. They're at a school, as Jill Biden was, or, Governor Newsom is on his, mobile phone or whatever they choose to do, in ways that in this new Zoom world that we teach from our homes and we, interact in ways that either allow a certain amount of performance as ever, or allow us to break down some of the barriers that we have between people. And it seems like that's a fundamental challenge, to politicians. And, even if you get, at past conventions, if you get some regular person up on stage in that kind of environment, it feels like they're a politician as opposed to a regular person because it's contextualized as such. And now you can do that in a way that feels way more normal, like they literally are the person next door because they're coming to you from next door.
Yeah, quite literally. Or seeing into people's home can in fact disrupt connections. So there's was a great moment at the Democratic convention where a governor is sitting in her kitchen and she says, "In kitchens like this one across America, families are gathering to struggle over bills." And we look behind her and it is this massive, sparkling kitchen. And I don't think there are very many kitchens like that across America.
Certainly, right? Not mine. Massive and definitely not sparkling.
Absolutely. It was a very comic moment about the disconnect between the professional political classes and the public. But the really effective part of this was the call from the roll call of the states. The Democrats made a point of we're carefully staging each state and had enormous diversity both between states in terms of who spoke and within individual states. So it was almost a Colors of Benetton ad, but it had the sense of seeing America open up and come together. The Republicans had almost entirely white spokesmen for every state, regardless of where it was, and very haphazardly selected locations, as if the geography wasn't really important. So if you put the two versions of America side by side, it would be very, very stark indeed. Even at a convention where the Republicans have managed to dig up more black and brown Republicans than I think I ever imagined might be out there, right? That they've found every black Republican leader, even down to state legislative levels, to put in front of the camera because they want to counter the very inclusive and diverse faces of the Democratic convention before.
Well, this can't help but lead me to, as you know, one of my favorite topics, and that's the decennial census, where the administration is, ironically or not, in contrast with what you just said, working really hard, it seems, to not count lots of people living in the United States, in particular, black and brown and poor folks. So if I can move us from those jokers to the deadly serious political games that they're engaging in, we talked about census last year, and as our listeners know or may not know, I've been working on it for the last 3 or so years, and we were prepared for sort of dis and misinformation around census because not many folks really understand what it is or why it matters. And that was what we were really concerned about, is helping people to understand the importance of census and blotting out amending dis and misinformation that was intended to get people not to respond or, in all kinds of misleading ways. And of course, we didn't see the kind of nefariousness that we expected and had seen in the 2016 elections coming from whether from state-based actors or from individuals or troublemakers or organized groups. What we did see was that coming from the executive branch and not from the Bureau, which has worked hard to demonstrate real integrity. But we saw it first with the Trump administration trying to nefariously add a citizenship question, which the court struck down, but which really sowed fear into the hearts of many immigrants as to how the census data would be used. And then we saw the onset of the pandemic, which was something that, of course, that none of us had predicted as we were preparing for census, which really challenged all kinds of things, including most notably the ability for enumerators to go door to door and to check in on the households who haven't responded. And so that was delayed until, you know, kind of mid-August, basically, a couple weeks ago, when they really started sending enumerators out instead of sending them out in the beginning of May. By that time, the administration had already sought and received an extension. And so the Bureau had decided to extend the enumeration process until the end of October of this year, as opposed to the end of July. So a couple, 3 extra months to do that enumeration, not extra in the sense of additional, but in terms of moving the lost months forward. And then the request had been initially to, instead of delivering the results of the census, so the count, to the president by the end of this calendar year, December 31st, 2020, for purposes of apportionment, deciding each state's representation in Congress, they had requested, and I believe from the House received, permission to delay that until the end of March, so that the Bureau would have time to adequately do the enumeration work and then to clean up the data and check the data and make sure that, you know, the count had the data were of high quality. So fast forward to at some point, the administration realizing that they maybe didn't want that. And first, moving up the end of enumeration from the end of October to the end of September, so cutting, removing a month that had been planned on, to introducing an executive order that said that they were going to basically try to remove all the data of of undocumented people living in the United States, which is against the law. And by the Constitution and court cases, everyone living in the United States, regardless of their status on census day, counts. So nefarious there. And, you know, with the full knowledge that many of the enumerators had been hired before, had applied before the pandemic, a lot of them were older and thus at higher risk. And so the rates of no-shows for enumerators have been terrifically high, in particular in some communities up to 60%, largely depending on when they were hired. But it means that the enumerators in many hard to count communities, for instance, Navajo Nation, have been are really hard pressed to be able to do the work. So you have not enough people to do the work. You have the extension that was made to the end of October move back, so you have less time to do it. And then lastly, the administration, the Senate and the executive are no longer apparently considering the extension of the delivery of the data to the White House, which is ostensibly because Trump wants to decide and recognizes that he may not win this fall. And he wants to be able to take that apportionment, the data from the census, take away, it seems, undocumented folks from that, and who knows what else he wants to do to that data before doing the apportionment process to Congress. So it is it's an incredibly troubling moment for, you know, so many people in orgs have worked really hard to have a good count. Past census directors are saying this could be the worst, you know, undercount, by far the worst undercount in modern times. And of course, that means in particular not getting lots of communities that are already underserved. And not having an accurate picture of our nation, and upsetting political, you know, sort of misrepresenting representation, as well as just data about communities. So right now we're in a terrible spot. And unlike the kind of pushback that we saw from Congress and lots of the nation around the USPS and the way that had been politicized and actively undermined by the Postmaster General and the White House, there isn't as much attention to the census, I think, because folks don't understand it. Maybe it's not in our daily lives in the same way. And I'm kind of struggling with how do we get out of this, because it's just hard to see a good outcome. Now, one outcome, and I'm going to stop in a second. Sorry, apologies for, you know, getting me wound up. is that everyone needs to fill out their census, go to mycensus.gov or, you know, online, or, and you can do a form, or the post office is mailing out forms again now to the communities that have higher non-response rates. Of course, with the post office totally disrupted, it's unclear whether they're, you know, what their capacity is to actually deliver people's responses if they do respond by mail. So all these things, the census, the post office, voting, are all connected, all undermined in some ways by the pandemic, but undermined actively by the administration, which continues to break, if not laws, certainly norms about how all this stuff works in ways that really risk undermining the fundamental integrity of our democracy and communities, as well as, you know, key institutions that support it, like the census.
I mean, it used to be that the, at least idealistically, it used to be that the civic infrastructure, the ways we resolve conflicts, the ways we work together to ensure the functioning of democracy, was not a subject of partisan political manipulation, right? I mean, I know we've had dead people voting in Chicago and so forth, but there has been a history of both the Republicans and Democrats caring to make sure that people were able to vote, to make sure that the people, the census worked. At least that's my romanticized sense of our past. And I think it's really disturbing to see the complacency with which some of this disruption takes place and the refusal to do anything about it, to even acknowledge the issue in many cases. I think with the post office, we're seeing some Republicans say, no, enough is enough, question this idea that whether voting for mail is any different from absentee voting, pointing out that the state of Utah, which is a Republican state, has had vote by mail for a long time with great success, which is for some backpedaling on that. But the census thing, you're right, I'm not seeing the degree of media coverage or public outrage that we should be hearing about this. Even from the Democratic National Convention, I don't think we heard nearly as much about the census disruption as we heard about the disruption of the Postal Service.
Yeah, it tends to be isolated by the kind of census nerds. One great place to keep abreast of it is by following Hansi Lo Wang on Twitter, who's, I think, the most dedicated journalist working on census issues today, and has done just a remarkable job since the start of helping folks learn about it and tracking what's happening. But it really is troubling. I mean, I think your romanticized notion, right? We are certainly aware that there were all sorts of historical barriers that certain states or regions placed against voting. And we've seen that, you know, continue to this day in places like Georgia and, you know, across the country. So it's not like there's not, there aren't nefarious efforts around to abridge these fundamental, you know, rights and responsibilities that we have. But I think the national consensus had been one of, like, in general, we want people to be able, you know, like, we're gonna duke it out, we're gonna hold it on a Tuesday, make it a little harder, do, you know, whatever. But people were still aligned that we needed to be together. And I think right now we're seeing that is absolutely not the case, and that they're, you know, they, and particularly the Republican Party, are willing, you know, they're with with Trump to really just say, hey, whatever goes as long as we win. And I think, you know, my hope is that we're reacting collectively in this in a way that says, no more, you know, we've had enough, we're not going to do this. It does, the level of, you know, malfeasance and, you know, evilness, though, is troubling in so many ways. And one of the things that it takes me back to regularly is in the way that so many of our conversations leave little nuggets that kind of keep bouncing around my head, is to the conversation we had last, I think, fall or winter with Cory Doctorow, in which, first, you know, we note that his the book of novellas that he, of short stories that we talked about on the show, he, of course, had The Mask of Red Death, which was about a pandemic. But he was talking about the next book that he's writing, and he was writing about sort of post-climate change and what reconciliation looks like. And that really has stuck with me, of this idea of the importance of finding some way not to just, you know, prosecute and vilify and otherwise marginalize whoever loses in these, you know, the conversations that we're talking about now, but to really look for ways that we can reconcile our differences and move on from them so that they don't become sort of characteristic of our society moving forward. And I really, that to me seems really important and also really difficult to see how that might play out.
No, I agree. This is the heart of what we mean by the civic, right? Is that space where we agree on the rules, we work together to ensure the game is played fairly. And after the battle of a campaign is over, we find ways to heal, to reconcile. You know, it's never quite worked that way, but I think it is something we should be working to achieve. And we need to figure out what those mechanisms are of reconciliation, of reparations, of healing. It helps if you have political leaders that actually try to govern the entire country and not their base. You know, it helps if there is a regular articulation of what we stand for as a community and that we find ways to discuss our aspirations, and we agree that when one battle is over, it's over, and we're not continually re-adjudicating every piece of legislation under each administration and unsettling things as much as we've seen in the last couple of decades. You know, some stability would help in dealing with that sense of reconciliation. But it also has to be on an individual level. And I think it's reconciliation is maybe our best response to the charges flying back and forth right now about cancel culture. You know, how do we accept past mistakes, apologize for them, allow people to change their behavior and be accepted into the society again? That's part of a reconciliation process. How do we understand that we're going to continue to make mistakes in dealing with each other? But an honest mistake is not the same thing as a malicious attack. That if what we're really struggling against is systemic problems, then personalizing and individualizing that again and again is not the most constructive way to allow the country to move together. And that's just one example of this larger range of things that we need to think about collectively if we're going to be able to resolve what has been the most divided America since the Civil War. You know, or we simply accept that America's doomed as a nation and democracy has failed as an experiment. Because for democracy to succeed, we have to find processes of reconciliation. And what Corey was talking about is something that's has been deeply in my thoughts ever since. And alongside it, Danielle Allen did an incredible episode of the Ezra Klein Show where she talked about reconciliation, which I strongly recommend and will stick the link to in our notes section, because she's been one of the most thoughtful thinkers trying to spell out what reconciliation might look like.
Yeah, I mean, I think to imagine having reconciliation with the most recent offenders, you know, let's just say that, which are largely bluntly characterized by Trump supporters, there's lots of other kinds of reconciliation that need to happen, right? So this is mistakes have been made all the way around. So I hope we can get into that a bit more over the course of the coming months, because boy, we have a lot of work to do. And I think, you know, between the uprisings in light of the George Floyd murder and, you know, sort of this campaign against anti-blackness and against systemic racism, the realities that we've seen in stark relief as a result of the pandemic and the other challenges that we mentioned today and over the course of spring, just feels like we have so much to do in the nation and the world. And, you know, we've kind of have the impetus, right? And we haven't even talked about climate change and the way that right now, literally, you know, there are 600 fires burning across California in addition, you know, the hurricanes and everything you mentioned. So the writing is on the wall, and, you know, not just in like faded spray paint, but in like neon, three dimensions, loud, you know, like with its own soundtrack, that we need to do things differently. And, you know, I think the question I have is, what's that going to look like? And are we going to do things differently in a way that, you know, take us back to where we were or some worse version? And I'm sure there are, you know, forces gathering in a dungeon somewhere that are hoping for that. Or are we going to engage in some of those reparations, engage in some of the civic imagination work that you do, where we're thinking about the future that we want and the communities and the society that we want, and taking active, real, and challenging steps towards towards a second American experiment, which builds on and learns from the first, but avoids some of the many failures that we've experienced.
You know, I think when we think about how we achieve reconciliation, I think how we reconstruct the past is part of that. So I want to sneak in as we're closing things down, a couple of recommendations to people that I think are doing interesting jobs in the popular culture space. I've been watching lately Perry Mason from HBO and Penny Dreadful, City of Angels from Showtime, both of which are set in Los Angeles in the 1930s. Perry Mason's a detective lawyer show. Penny Dreadful is a horror show, but they're both dealing with the real world challenges that Los Angeles politics went through during that period, and are doing really powerful jobs, not only reconstructing the physical geography of Los Angeles, the different neighborhoods, their vibes, their atmospheres, but really digging into the racial history of Los Angeles, dealing with Black and Mexican issues in Perry Mason. And then particularly in Penny Dreadful, we're seeing the Nazi Bund operating in Los Angeles. And alongside that, we're seeing the politics of Chicano identity and building toward, I suspect, the Zoot Suit riots period of Los Angeles history, which they're tying into corrupt politics and transportation politics in Los Angeles. A lot of this is stuff we haven't seen on the screen before. And it's a product of the more inclusive hiring that we're seeing at the current time. So that even what might seem on the surface to be basic genre entertainment is telling us stories of wounds of the past that haven't been acknowledged and asking us to think through how they might parallel the current conditions we're facing today. And they're also, just as an aside, they both have Amy Semple McPherson as a central figure representing the religious politics of Los Angeles. And I think it's interesting to see the very different way these two shows deal with this important historical personage in the city's history. So if people are looking for things to watch that may help us think further about this process, I certainly strongly recommend both of those.
So that's thanks for those recs. Definitely interested. And it does, you know, as you're talking about the Zoot Suit riots and so on, and including things that have been excluded, immediately, you know, Watchmen comes to mind, and its treatment of the 1921 massacre in Tulsa. And I, you know, like that, the normalization and inclusion of histories not written by the air quotes victors, you know, that that acknowledge and dig into some of these terrible events in our past that have shaped life and created trauma for so many communities just seems like a pretty remarkable step forward. And one that, you know, in ways that take it on as a, you know, that really kind of lean into it, and others just that make it part of the storyline, that acknowledge it and make it real and allow people and the experiences that they're familiar with to be seen. So to me, that feels like amid all of these, you know, the plagues and pestilence that you mentioned earlier, it does feel like we are making progress in some ways. And, you know, even just most recently, this, you know, sort of what's now called the Washington Football Club, after decades and decades of criticism of its name and mascot, abruptly changing and agreeing to do away with its name of the Redskins is just, you know, a really positive step. And so I like to think that, and there's, you know, some other gains in that space, and also still so much to do. I mean, we're making remarkable progress around anti-Blackness, or at least awareness raising, yet Native Americans are, you know, there's just an incredible amount of work to be done there, and everything from, you know, teams and their mascots to where those communities are seen and how they're seen, and how their histories are seen in mainstream media and in our lives. So I do feel like it's great that we've made some steps, and there remains so much more work to do.
Well, how do you like it so far? No, I mean, well, seriously, the point of our podcast is mapping this process of change and dissatisfaction and continual debate and reconciliation all through the lens of popular culture.
Well, it has been an absolute treat to be talking with you today, Henry. I feel like, as I always do, learned so much and laughed out loud more than a few times based on your wit. So thank you. And I could not be more excited about our upcoming fall season. So let's get the ball rolling.
So as we were putting this podcast to bed, we got the shocking news of the death of Chadwick Boseman, who has been an iconic Black actor, associated perhaps in our world most fully with Black Panther, but who's played a number of kind of important figures from Jackie Robinson to Thurgood Marshall, and has really been a leader beyond the sixth screen, a leader in social movements over the last few years, helping people who've been stimulated into political life by things like Black Panther to make the connection to Black Lives Matter and some of the social justice movements that are taking place in the streets as we speak.
Yeah, it just is it's an incredible loss. And, you know, the kind of loss like that you don't even imagine is possible until he's gone. And then to learn that he was able to make so many amazing films and to do so much leadership and engagement with community, even as he was fighting an advanced stage of cancer, is just, you know, that much more incredible. So it's truly tragic, and also at the same time inspirational that he got to play these, you know, the other character you didn't mention, or character, the other human you didn't mention, is James Brown, right? He plays some of the most amazing and like a wide range of these amazing people. And brings real life and honesty and joy and humanity to them. So I'm just sad, you know?
Yeah, it's one more blow at the end of a really painful week for all of us. You know, and yet, you know, we did several episodes early in the run of How Do You Like It So Far on Black Panther. And I think I'm happy we captured some of the excitement around that film's release and the idea that this has helped stimulate a movement, that it's tied to Afrofuturism and the kind of explosion of interest that artistic, literary, ethical, political movement received. We have an episode coming up on fan activism that talks a bit about that legacy. And I think it's hard to imagine the full impact of Black Panther without him playing that leading role.
True that, true that. Well, rest in power, Chadwick Boseman. Just a quick but heartfelt word of thanks to our amazing production team who makes this all happen. Josh Chang, Karin Navatia, and Sophie Maggi.
Thanks to the continuing support for both the Civic Imagination Project and the Civic Media Fellows here at USC by the MacArthur Foundation.
Huge thanks to our awesome colleagues at the University of Southern California who give us lots of ideas, moral support, and sometimes even listen to the show.
You never write. Write us at HDYLIS_podcast on Instagram and Twitter. We are now Insta-worthy.